this is Dr. Susan Kalb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Larry Dossey and his new book, The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. Dr. Dossey is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Healing Words, and many other books. We've interviewed him on many of them, and we're pleased to have him back. Dr. Dossey, are you calling from New Mexico?
Yeah, I'm sitting in my office in Santa Fe in northern New Mexico, Susan.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today. I enjoyed your book tremendously. I think my whole life has been kind of a training ground for interpretation of premonitions, especially those involving surgery as well as the determination of what's going on in the body. So we've got some very strange new diseases coming into existence that we're having to figure out, and certainly premonition and this kind of knowing that you discuss in this book is critical to figuring these out. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your personal experience with premonitions and how that sparked an interest in this material?
Yes, I'd be happy to. This goes back to my very first year in medical practice as an internal medicine physician in Dallas, Texas. I had a vivid dream one night in which I saw the four-year-old son of one of my medical colleagues in my medical group having some sort of test done. He was lying on an examination table. A technician was doing a brainwave test on his head, or at least was trying to do that. His mother was standing by him, trying to lend comfort to this boy, but nothing was working. He just went berserk. And he was kicking and screaming and fighting. And finally, in disgust, the technician threw up her hands and said, "I quit," and turned around and walked away. And that was the dream. And I woke up. I thought this was one of the strangest dreams I'd ever had. And I also thought at the time it was one of the most vivid dreams in my life. And I couldn't figure out why, because it seemed so nonsensical. But I went to work that morning and made hospital rounds and saw patients all morning. And at lunch, I found myself sitting in our luncheon area having a bite with the father of this little boy, my colleague. And all of a sudden, into the area walks his wife carrying this little boy. And his hair is wet, and he's crying, and he's upset, and obviously extremely unhappy. And she proceeds to tell her husband my dream.
My goodness.
I was shocked. She described mm-hmm. it as she had just come from the EEG lab, and the whole procedure went south, and it was just a disaster. And I was unnerved. You know, at that point in my life, I knew that the world couldn't work like that. But there it was. I discussed this with my colleague, the father, and he didn't want to talk about it.
You know how
doctors think
right.
about these things. And, you know, forever thereafter, he refused to bring it up. And so it remained just a completely closed subject. And later on, years and years later, when the research documenting the ability of people to see into the future in these computerized tests, which I write about, this incident came back to me in full force, and I realized that I'd got a pretty good preview of what this what this stuff was about, you know, early on in my practice.
Yeah. Well, I had a very interesting first precognitive dream, and I want to point out to the audience that precognitive dreams have a different quality to them. They're not as like confusing or going back and forth, non-vivid. Precognitive dreams are very, very, it's almost like you're right there watching it. My first dream was when I was a medical student, and I had a dream that my friend, who was at a different medical school, was murdered on a ski trail. And it was so vivid that I called her, and she was actually at Hahnemann, and I said, "Are you going to go skiing?" Because she and her husband went a lot, and she said, "Yeah, we're going to go to Colorado." And I said, "Well, let me tell you about my dream." And so I did, and she said, "Well, I'm going to cancel my ski trip." And we never thought much about it until I was studying, I studied a lot about the FBI profiler, things later in life, and There was, at that particular time, although he hadn't been caught yet, a serial killer in the area she was going to, that the profilers had been so good that they even predicted that he had a physical impairment like stuttering, and when they actually caught him, he was a stutterer. And she reminded me of that because she visited Atlanta, I guess, last year, and she was attending a meeting, a national meeting here, and we went out to dinner, and she reminded me that that she didn't go on that ski trip because of that dream.
I'll be. Well, that's fascinating. You know, I was on book tour for this book back in June when the Air France 447 flight crashed into the Atlantic when it was
right.
flying from Rio back to Europe. And the next day, on Dutch television, a guy named Steven Van Os popped up with a story very similar to yours. He did not have a premonition or a dream that that flight was going to crash and carry down, I think, 220-something people with it.
Mm-hmm.
But a friend of his did, as in your case. His friend had a dream
mm-hmm.
and told Stephen before that flight that if he gets on it, he will never come back alive.
Right.
And so on the basis of his friend's dream, he canceled his reservation and lived to tell about it.
Well, that takes a great deal of, faith, which is really, I think that's one of the tests we create for ourselves here, is the test of faith. I mean, you know, now especially when you can't get any money back from canceling your airline reservations in many cases, you know, and you probably are going to disappoint a lot of people, and, you know, you might be, like you are, on book tour with all these things. I mean, it takes a great deal of faith to step out and actually cancel a trip. In your book, you mentioned that sometimes people who have premonitions about traveling and especially airline crashes will change the time they fly, which
right.
is another alternative rather than just
right.
canceling it. And I found fascinating in your book the data that you put in there about the airplanes, the four airplanes on 9/11, 2001, and how they were not at all full. In fact, were they about 25% to capacity?
They were 21% occupied.
21%,
and,
right.
And on average, and this held not just for, you know, one or two of these planes. It was all four of these doomed airplanes. I think that most Americans have an erroneous idea about what happened with respect to all of those planes. The image that prevails seems to be that there were four jam-packed full planes that you know, crashed that day, and it just wasn't
mm-hmm.
the case. The vacancy rate was very high. It averaged 79%. I don't know about you, but I don't get on airplanes that are, you know, 21% full. I don't think I've ever had that experience, and it brings
it's
up
very
you know,
unusual.
Whether or not people, you know, unconsciously have some reason to change their travel plans.
Well, and I have something very interesting to add that I just learned about this last week to that. One of my, the husband of one of my patients, his mother was on that plane that supposedly crashed into the Pentagon, although there's some question about whether that was a missile or a plane. But in any case, she was on there, and he's fairly intuitive, and the last time he saw her, he hugged her. And then he knew that that was going to be the last time that, you know, what he heard is, remember this moment. I don't think he knew that that was the last time, but it was something in his consciousness pointed out to him that this was a significant moment.
Yeah.
But when I asked him about his mother, he said, oh, no, she was ready to go. She wanted to go. So what about the idea that the 21%, that maybe half of them were ready to go and just chose that as a way out?
Well, that's fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah,
I hadn't either.
Yeah.
But she said, I mean, he said she definitely didn't want to stay here. You know, and people get like that. I mean, we've all known people. My mother had after my dad died, they'd been married over 60 years. You know, she went through a period where she was deciding whether or not she was going to go or stay. And I said to her, I said, Mom, I think you can go out now if you want. I mean, I think you have a choice, but you don't have to. And then I proceeded to tell her that she did have a future if she chose to stay. But, you know, people don't realize that we actually probably have more of a, there are times when I think our conscious and subconscious come together and that we might have conscious choice whether or not to go or stay. So maybe some of those people who actually went on the plane at a subconscious level knew that they were just, you know, that it was just an easier way to go out than maybe cancer or some other long drawn out disease.
Well, that's an absolutely fascinating consideration, and I'll think about that. I have had the opportunity to talk to several people who had reservations on airplanes that crashed, and I have yet to find one who actually saw the crash itself.
Right.
You know, it's a subconscious itch or nudging. You know, it's like, you know, there's just something wrong. I don't know what
right.
it is, but I just don't feel right about traveling today. And it's so vivid for those folks that they change their travel plans. But I think it's rare that people actually see a plane crashing.
There's some report I read somewhere, I can't remember where, but that there have been reports of people who can see auras that when they got on the plane, nobody had an aura around them. In other words, their energy that is coming in from other dimensions, or however you want to describe the aura, the life force energy, is waning around everybody in the plane. And this person said they actually got off the plane when they saw that. So that would be interesting. You know, Valerie Hunt has a machine to measure that energy. You know, I mean, that can actually be measured. She has a machine there that can actually measure how much red frequency is in your aura at a site, like, say, if you have a painful shoulder. And that would be good for workman's comp cases, because a lot of the workman's comp insurance companies are saying the patient's, you know, like exaggerating their pain. I think we could measure that pain.
Great idea.
But you know, I think if we could study this, I think we would find very interesting, I guess, agreements would be the best word. I think we all have agreements that we may or may not be conscious of. And I think actually, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've kind of come to the conclusion that really everything always is in divine order. It's just, it doesn't appear that way for the minute, maybe, but but in the long run, it's everything acts in concert for the best. And we have to drop some of our limiting belief systems that consciousness doesn't survive after death, and that, you know,
and it's locked into the brain and the body in the present moment.
That the brain creates the mind, you know, kind of the backwards thinking that has kind of gotten us into the materialistic world rather than more into the spiritual world.
You know, there may be some people who are listening who think that these stories of people avoiding plane crashes are just anecdotes and have no evidentiary weight at all. But I want to add that there was one study which was done properly and put this on a good footing that was done back in the 1950s, not with plane crashes, but with train crashes. In the 50s, train travel was a lot more popular than today, of course. And, there was a researcher, William Cox, who just had the idea that from the reports that he read that there always seemed to be fewer passengers on the train the day it crashed than at other times.
Right.
So he looked at 28 consecutive train wrecks and compared the occupancy rate on the day of the crash with the occupancy rate 7, 14, 21, and 28 days prior, just to have something to compare. So he found out that in every case, and there was no exception to this, on the day of the train wreck, the occupancy rate was statistically lower than on the preceding weeks of the month. And it was a great study because it, you know, had comparison data to it, and the statistics were overwhelming. People seemed to find some reason not to travel on the day of the train wreck.
Yeah, I think we have guidance. I think we have all sorts of guidance. And I want to relay a story. I think we have the subtle guidance, like the feeling. You know, you talk in your book about how the autonomic nervous system is tied into everything. So, you know, you could get diarrhea. You could get, you know, you could have all sorts of physical symptoms. You can get headaches. You mentioned the surgeon, that neurosurgeon that was blocking what he was supposed to be doing was getting headaches. You know, we have all sorts of things that can happen that way. But I worked in the Brooke Army burn unit, which in the military, and I had a patient in there who woke up in the middle of the night and a voice, I mean a literal voice, told her in no uncertain terms to get out of the house now. So she ran out of the house, and as she was running out the front door, the whole house exploded with a gas thing, and it burned her whole back. So obviously she still ended up in the burn unit with us. But she told me herself that, you know, she never heard voices, she never, none of this stuff, you know, but from a dead sleep, she woke up with this voice kind of like really encouraging her to get out of the house now. It was like now.
Yeah.
And she lived. That's right. She certainly wouldn't have lived because I guess, you know, when the gas and the flame unite and there's enough gas, you have quite a big explosion. She couldn't have survived that.
You know, it's interesting you bring this up because in the book I talk about a fantastic event that happened in a little town in southeastern Nebraska called Beatrice in 1950, in which 15 choir members were supposed to show up for choir practice at this little Baptist church on this particular night. But for the first time in church history, it was a complete no-show. Nobody
mm-hmm.
showed up. It never happened before. And about 5 minutes after choir practice would have started, the church blew up. It was a gas explosion. And if anybody had been there, they would have been killed. It was a massive explosion
mm-hmm.
that blew out windows all through the town. And so that's just an example of how this stuff can be collective, you know, and mutually shared between large groups of people.
And I like in your book how you describe some of the reasons that people didn't go in, you know. One just felt lazy, you know. I'm not sure feeling lazy would work with me, you know. You know, this type A personality, I can't be allowed to feel lazy. I probably have some sort of other warning. I had an interesting thing happen. I was on my way down to the DeKalb Medical Center for an auto accident. I was on call as a plastic surgeon. And the guy was in CAT scan, and CAT scan takes a while, as you know. So I was going to stop and get gas at the Quick Trip because the Quick Trip's cheap. It's, you know, better gas price. And a voice told me, absolutely not. That's what I heard, absolutely not. Not a voice like your voice, but a voice, you know, in my head, like a, you know, it wasn't my voice either. It was like, absolutely not. Well, what I thought was maybe this guy was going to get into trouble. Sometimes they get in trouble in CAT scan, and really only the surgeon can get him out of trouble. You know, nobody else has the knowledge to. So I went on in. But no, I had to sit around and wait, and then I had to take him to surgery. And when I came back out of surgery, I drove back by that Quick Trip, and it was surrounded by police tape, and there were 7 police cars. Guess what happened?
Yeah.
A psychiatric patient was being taken to the same center by his wife, but she ran out of gas, so she stopped there. He got a gun out of the car, you know, whatever the front of the car there, yeah, and he shot 4 people and injured 3. At the exact same time I would have been there.
Well, you're really tapped in.
Well, that little voice, absolutely. It wasn't so little that time. Absolutely not. And
well,
isn't
great.
That interesting? But
yeah,
it can be very protective. So I guess my message to people is when you hear these messages, and they can be subtle or they can be dreams, they can be thoughts in your head, or they can be actual voices like my patient heard, you know, waking her out of a sleep. She interpreted it as an external voice, which I think the angels can do. You need to listen to that and ask questions later. Don't become a skeptic right then.
Carl Jung, the great psychologist, said that if a premonition, whether it's a waking intuition or a dream message,
right,
if it involves death, pay attention to it because
right.
you may not get a second chance.
I think that's really true, and I think that we have a lot of protection. I think that I've always felt that it's little things. I mean, I'll tell you a story that's really interesting. I was on my way to work, and I saw that somebody was going to steal the picture out of the patient bathroom in my clinic, and I went, "That's stupid. Nobody had ever steal the picture." And I went in and didn't take the picture out, and that evening, the picture was gone. So,
wow.
You know, protective stuff is around us all the time. and yet not everything is going to be shown to you. I had absolutely no premonition that I was going to fall and break my arm because it was supposed to happen. It was supposed to happen so that I would not work so much and that I would not develop lung cancer. Do you know Colette Baron-Reed? She's a psychic that was taking over for Sylvia Brown. They were traveling together. I was interviewing her on Remembering the Future, and I said to her, I said, yeah, you know, I fell and broke my arm. I was off work for 4 months. And she said, oh, you were going to develop cancer, and now you're not. So even these horrible accidents, you would say for a surgeon, that's just terrible to break your arm. It's actually a blessing. That's where I came to the realization that everything always is in divine order,
well,
even when
share,
something horrible seems to happen.
Let me share one with you that involved someone you may know, Rupert Sheldrake, the British
right.
biologist who's written
yeah.
widely about morphogenetic fields and the
right.
nature of consciousness and so on. Well, 3 years ago, he was giving a lecture at a national meeting that was held here in Santa Fe, my hometown. And after his talk, and this was a conference on the nature of consciousness,
Right.
So after he gave the closing lecture, the keynote lecture to this conference, a young Japanese national who was a paranoid schizophrenic rushed up to the podium with a dagger, tried to stab him in the chest.
You're kidding.
Tripped and stabbed him in the upper leg, barely missing the femoral artery.
Oh, my.
I became involved with the case and helped him get through surgery and make the
mm-hmm.
right choices here in Santa Fe. And
oh,
long story short, he you know, did very well and survived without even any limp at all.
Mm-hmm.
But here you had hundreds of people at a conference on consciousness. Dr. Sheldrake is a world's authority on how consciousness operates,
mm-hmm.
and I had just finished my manuscript on seeing the future, the power of premonitions.
Right.
And would you believe it, not a single individual in this whole group of hundreds of people, including Sheldrake and myself, who were focused on premonitions,
right.
had a conscious clue that this was going on. And
isn't that fascinating?
It is. And Rupert to this day thinks that the whole thing resulted in a focusing in his life and his work. And so
mm-hmm.
it may be that, you know, this is a dramatic example of your contention that things do work in divine order.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, maybe the person who stabbed him needed to have a, you know, because there was a higher energy in that room, as you know.
Yes.
I mean, you know, just as how energy works. So the energy in that room would have been very high. And maybe that's what protected Sheldrake, and yet was able to get this guy help before he actually murdered somebody. Because,
yeah.
you know, say in a crowded subway or, you know, somewhere else where the energy's lower, he probably wouldn't have tripped. You know,
well,
he probably would have been right on into the heart.
I called that the divine trip.
Really? The divine trip? That's fascinating.
If he had not tripped, he well may just have pierced his heart, because that's where he was trying to go.
Right, and he was probably pretty good at that. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, whether I trip and break my arm or he trips and misses the heart, the trip is probably hooked into what we would call the universal consciousness. I mean, you know, have you ever been walking along and it just tripped and said, how did that happen? You know, like, it's like really, it was really funny. One time I was walking along and I had a negative thought about somebody and then I tripped and I went, "Ooh, better be careful."
Yeah, I know. Just one of those funny coincidences.
Just one of those things, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, I guess your book at the end talks about the consciousness, you know, the framework in which to understand premonitions. Would you like to comment a little bit about what you've learned, what larger framework we can put this in?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that the premonitions that people have of impending health challenges and dangers are quite wonderful. They do give us an advantage in survival, and we ought to pay attention to them. But I think that there are larger lessons that go beyond even the contributions they make to our physical survival and health.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the message that comes from these premonitions is that there's some quality of our conscience, some factor of the mind that is just not in time. It can range into the future. It can range into the past. It certainly can range far and wide in space. You and I have talked in the past about how to language this this kind of consciousness. I would like to call it non-local mind,
mm-hmm.
because it's a picture of the mind in which it's not localized to specific points in space, such as the brain or the body, and certainly it's not localized to specific points in time, such as the present. That's what premonitions show us. So I believe that the big lesson from premonitions is that they point like an arrow toward immortality,
mm-hmm.
which is a way of being outside of time, of being eternal. I can't think of a greater contribution of premonitions to human understanding than that message that there is something beyond physical death, and this is indirect evidence for that, in my judgment. So I think that's the huge lesson that these things give us. You know, if they help us survive and avoid
mm-hmm.
cancer or dangers, then, you know, that's all to the good. But I think we ought to keep our eye on the larger message.
I don't know whether you had ever heard Russell Targ's experiment where they were trying to show that consciousness survives death, involving chess. Had you ever heard that one?
No, I have not.
It's fascinating because they're using a skill rather than information. Many of the other ones are, and they're great experiments, but they're using information. But information can be telepathically transferred. There's other explanations for that. Well, Targ decided to use a medium to go into the afterlife to find a former chess grandmaster. And she found one who was Hungarian and had been second in the world when he was alive. And through the medium, who really didn't play chess, he played a current grandmaster. And they did 60 moves before the Hungarian lost. And Bobby Fischer was Targ's brother-in-law.
Yes.
And Bobby looked at the 60 moves and said only a chess grandmaster would have gone 60 moves. And the Hungarian said through the medium that he would have done better, but he'd been dead for a while. So we can deduce that they do not play chess in the afterlife, which is interesting.
Somehow I'm comforted by that since I've never chess played.
But that is really powerful evidence for the existence of consciousness after death. That's one of the most powerful things I've ever heard, experiments I've ever heard. And I've interviewed Gary Schwartz and, you know, many of the, and Dean Raitt and many of the other scientists who are working on this. But I think that, you know, with evidence like that, we should assume that some form of consciousness survives death. But this idea of the eternal now is fascinating to me. Targ discovered that in the remote viewing experiments, there was no difference in accuracy whether they remote viewed in the past, present, or future.
Yeah.
Now that is fascinating.
Well, I think it's fascinating also. And it ties in with the fact that in healing experiments where people use their intentions to try to make people better at a distance, the outcome of those studies is not any better if the healer is at the bedside than if the healer is on the other side of the earth.
That's true.
So, you know, the whole business of space and time is what Einstein would have called relativized. It's just not fundamental.
And you mentioned in your book that there were experiments that actually had people pray into the past,
right,
for people who were ill. You want to talk about that? That's fascinating, too.
Well, there's one study that was published in the British Medical Journal, one of the world's great medical journals, of what was called retroactive prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this sounds absolutely nutty, but the person who did the praying prayed for people who had been hospitalized 4 to 10 years previously.
Mm-hmm.
They all had sepsis, bloodstream poisoning, and
mm-hmm.
and so the people who received the prayer, when they analyzed their charts, actually had a better clinical hospital course than the people who weren't given prayer in the present. So this is prayer after somebody has gone through a hospital experience. Now, people need to, you know, not get bent out of shape about that. I think there are ways to understand that might have to do with randomization of patients and all of this sort of thing. I think that that's one of the most difficult studies I've ever come across for people to grok, to get their minds around. But it's on the books, and it's just further evidence that time is not fundamental.
Well, did you ever read Deepak Chopra's The Book of Secrets?
I have not read that book yet.
You might want to read that, because that is doing it in the opposite direction. But Deepak talks about Rishi masters who lived 5,000 years ago, who went into altered states of consciousness and wrote on these scrolls, these histories of people who were going to be born later on.
Uh-huh.
And so he went and got his, and of course it said Deepak Chopra, his date of birth, his parents' name, and then on down who he married, his children, a little bit about his life, and then the date of his death at the end. And he said that he didn't think it was right because his mother's name was different than what he thought. So, but when he asked her, that was actually her name. She'd never even told her kids what her real name was because she didn't like it.
Good heavens.
And so basically, you see, that's the other direction. So
yeah.
Somebody in the past going into an altered state of consciousness to access this, you know, universal mind or whatever you want to call it, Akashic field, like Irvin Laszlo calls it, will be able to very accurately predict the major points of somebody's life and do it over and over and over again. Now, that puts into question the idea of free will. And I think you would agree with me that most people get really bent out of shape about all of this because you're attacking free will.
Right.
You know, isn't that the truth?
Well, people go ballistic over that.
They go ballistic, exactly. But it's always because, oh, then I have no free will.
Yeah.
I think people do have free will, but the more evolved you are in understanding what's going on, you're not likely to make rash decisions because you're better guided. But I do think that people, I mean, Edgar Cayce said that you can. I mean, there is some room for just stupid things. You know, you all of a sudden get overwhelmed by a feeling you want to kill yourself, go reach in the drawer and shoot yourself in the head.
Yeah.
You know, that probably didn't have to happen. You know, that probably is a conscious decision.
You know,
an insane decision, depending on, you know, your state of mind at the time.
Yeah.
But the question is, would the Rishi master have been able to, you know, end with a shot to the head, or would there be other alternate realities? And how did the Rishi master be able to be accurate? And the only thing you can come up with, Larry, is that there is the eternal now and that time is illusionary.
Yeah. Well, I really come down hard on this business of the nature of time and that we really basically are ignorant about what time is. I have really spent a lot of time looking at the philosophies of current hotshot physicists who spend their lives tinkering with what time may be.
Right.
You can't come up with any kind of consistent picture. They don't agree on what time actually is, but here's one thing they all agree on, and it is the fact that our common sense notion that time flows in one direction is absolutely fundamentally wrong. Everyone agrees in physics about that.
You have all of that in your book. That you've written all of that in the appendix, the first appendix.
Right.
Yeah, that's a wonderful compilation of this information.
Can I get back to free will for just a second?
Sure.
The image that I carry around in my head about how to think about free will is that the future is probable. It's not written in stone. The image that we might have in a premonition is the one that may be most likely to happen. But probability is exactly that. It's wishy-washy, you know, it's fuzzy, it's ambiguous. And the choices that we make as the future evolves can push the probability in one direction or another. And so I think free will may be preserved in something of that fashion.
And I think that your book, The Power of Premonitions, really shows us that when we start to go off course, or say, like in my case, my friend who was in medical school starts to go off course, either your own premonition or someone you know, a lot of time it's your mother, you know that. Your mother has a premonition, isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
And or someone close to you has a premonition. And you really ought to pay attention to this information. It's information coming from a higher dimensional awareness that probably can see across time. probably is in what the, you know, the physicist that you quote called eternal now.
Right.
I think time and space, I mean, for me, I have come to the conclusion after interviewing over 30 physicists and consciousness researchers, and, you know, we've been doing this radio show for over 13 years, so I've read a few books. And I come to the conclusion that time and space are constructs.
Yeah.
They are constructs that we have built in order to have an arena in which to learn certain lessons, because without them, we wouldn't be able to learn those lessons. Because
mm-hmm.
when you're in the eternal now, you have different set of challenges, different set of how things work. When you think something in the eternal now, you're there. You know,
yeah.
you don't have to get on a plane and, you know, and fly halfway across the world to get, you know, to get to Australia.
Precisely. You know, getting back to this idea of your mother,
mm-hmm.
there's some lessons that come to us in the premonition research that does focus on mothers. If I had to pick one motif in
mm-hmm.
premonitions, it would be a mother who sees a child in danger and
right.
acts to correct or prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes one ask, what is that all about? And I think it's pretty simple. I think it has to do with love.
It does.
I think love and empathy and compassion and deep, heartfelt caring catalyze so much of this ability to see into the future on behalf of those that we really do love. And that's where mother's intuitions come in. You know, there used to be an old term that was in wide use in the 19th century called mother wit.
Mm-hmm.
And mother wit just sort of captures so much. Mothers just know things.
Yep.
You know, and boy, do they ever. Sometimes there's some of the great great psychics, you know, during the mothering years, you know, and
mm-hmm.
even afterwards. Often, if you look at the family histories of people who claim themselves to be psychic, it will usually be a woman whose mother
mm-hmm.
was psychic and her grandmother
mm-hmm.
and her mother before her. And it seems to follow on the female side of the family so often. I don't know that that's genetic so much as it is the capacity of mothers to love their children.
That's true. And in your book, I'm trying to find where, but I can't find where right now, you actually go through qualities of people who are more likely to have premonitions.
Yeah, I think these qualities are often overlooked. And most people who are really skillful psychics have some of these. They tend to have a high tolerance for absorption, the ability
mm-hmm.
to focus on something and, you know, and even use your fantasy and imagination while doing that.
Right, yeah.
They seem to be connected through a sense of oneness with
mm-hmm.
with all of life, you know, not just other people, but all living things. They tend to believe in the transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
They're really high on compassion and empathy. They're highly intuitive. And here's one that I really love. They really are comfortable with chaos and disorder.
Right.
Because I mean,
you know, it doesn't threaten them.
Well, I know.
They can navigate through it.
I know. And they have a sense of meaning and purpose in life. They don't think
right.
things are just drifting aimlessly in life like a lot
mm-hmm.
of people do. They're usually very positive people. They're
mm-hmm.
productive. They have a huge respect for the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, those are some of the things that
yeah.
I think
they love animals, too. I mean,
well,
truly
yeah.
love
yeah.
other kingdoms.
Yeah, yeah.
And don't just think that they're superior. I think that, you know, I think there was a saying that I think came out of the Bible, pride is the mother of all sins.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, lack of humility will be the antidote to killing, or will be what kills the ability to have this premonition and this look into the future. Even if it's just 5 minutes, I mean, it doesn't matter how far into the future you can look, it's always a gift in my mind.
I think
it's a great gift, and it's
yeah.
protective.
Yes, it has a survival value.
Yeah.
I think that gets back to the notion of where all this started in the human species. And my hunch is that it started very, very early in our history in probably the predator-prey relationship. Because
finding out where the animals were.
Exactly. If you knew
yeah.
even just a few seconds ahead of where the danger
right.
lay, you could take a measures to avoid it. And
I
think that may be one reason why people seem to, it seems to be so widespread now. My hunch is that by this time we're all sort of genetically endowed to some degree with this ability, and that it's extremely widespread in our species.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that the people who lack it or have it but disregard it often have serious problems, you know, especially, I mean, it's not all that safe to drive out on the highways if you think about it. I mean,
right.
It's not all that safe to, you know, the fighter pilots used to talk about the big sky theory, you know, the planes didn't run into each other just because it was a big sky, you know, but there were a lot of near misses, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So, I talked to any pilot. So, your intuition and all of the surgeons I know and all of the fighter pilots I know, because I spent many years in the military, are very intuitive, the good ones. The good ones are extremely intuitive, and they know. One of my friends was a fighter pilot, and he said, you know how I know someone has their guns on me? I said, how? He says, because the back of my neck tickles.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, there you are. That's the autonomic nervous system getting
again. Yeah, way before the, you know, the system in the plane, which is there to detect, you know, because the actual electronic system is less. Because you know what? The minute the person behind him intends to put him in the crosshairs.
Right.
That's when he gets that,
yeah.
You see.
Right.
And then he maneuvers the plane, and he was actually felt to be the best fighter pilot in the unit, and that unit was felt to be the best in the country. So this guy was, you know, pretty good.
Yeah.
And he told me a couple of things that were interesting. He told me that, and then he told me, he showed me a picture of a World War I fighter pilot, and he said, I was that person. He says, that was me, and I died in fight, you know, doing air-to-air fights. And this guy was not at all spiritual. This guy was not, I mean, I think he never told anybody except me that, because he knew that I was studying reincarnation. And that was weird. So maybe the best of us have done it before, you know, the best of us have more than one. Mozart wasn't just Mozart, you know. So that might actually come into play, that we actually get it right. You know, we actually keep going until we get it right.
Practice makes perfect, Susan.
It does. It does. So what is your, I wanted to have you give your contact information, your website.
Yeah, my wife and I share a website. She's an author as well. So it's DossieDossie.com. It's two Dossies. Dossie is D-O-S-S-E-Y.
And you've got up there the extraordinary healing power of ordinary things,
mm-hmm.
healing beyond the body, reinventing medicine. And I love this one. Be careful what you pray for. You might just get it. And that was a book on negative prayer, which it really needed to be written. And Healing Words, which was a really good book. And let's see, this is the first book that I read. The first book I read was Space, Time, and Medicine.
That's the first book I wrote. Yep.
There you go.
Back in 1982.
You're still studying that, aren't you?
it's captured me. I can't get away from it. I don't want to get away from it.
Well, that was a great book, too. But it's really good. So what are you working on now? Do you have a next project?
Yeah, I actually am knee-deep in a project. I'm writing a book on miracles.
Great.
I want to say something about miracles that hasn't been said before and take it out of, you know, the theological religious context that it usually winds up in. And
right.
So I'm having a terrific time putting this book together, so stay tuned.
Yeah, that'll be great. You've heard the saying, we don't believe in miracles, we depend on them. That's kind of how we run our office over here.
Oh, that's great.
Well, not all the time, but, you know, we depend on them. So do you have any appearances that you want to talk about?
I actually have sort of wound down my appearances for this year.
Okay.
Next year, I'm going to be in New York City on March the 18th. And all of these, and there will be many, many more appearances in the coming spring, but I haven't put very many of those up yet on my website. Many of them are still in flux, so they'll be up there. People can follow my meanderings, if they so choose, on the website.
Great. Do you have any closing messages for our listeners? Anything
yeah,
that you'd like to leave them with?
Yeah, I would. I know people who hear us chat about this wonder sometimes about how they might be more premonition prone, and mm-hmm. I just think that nothing works like being faithful in a meditation practice, because it's a way of just sitting down and inviting messages to surface from our unconscious. And if we learn to do that, almost everyone will attest that they become more sensitive to messages from the future. And God knows that meditation has a lot of benefits for people, but this business of premonitions, it happens to be one of them. And also keeping a dream diary, if people want to, you know, freshen up their premonition mm-hmm. sense, that's one way to do it, because if people do that, then they open a space in their life, in their consciousness, for an increased frequency of premonitions. If you keep a dream diary, you're going to find out that you have more premonitory dreams. And so meditation and keeping a dream diary are two really practical ways for people to come on board with this.
We have a meditation group that meets weekly, and we had posed some questions and gotten some information that was very interesting. Most of us are medical, so back before the swine flu, we asked if we should take the bird flu vaccine, which was, you know, maybe going to be developed if it came out. And the answer was not necessarily, because some of it had the bird flu in it. And 2 weeks later, Baxter putting the bird flu vaccine in the bird flu in the vaccine broke into the news. And then in early April, we were again asking about the flu, and we heard that we would be in a flu pandemic by the end of April, and that's when the swine flu pandemic began.
Yeah.
So for us, it's part of what we do. I mean, we actually are very grateful that we have this information, and it's a collective thing. You know, it's the whole group. And it's not just me or another person. It's the whole group that's important for, having the consciousness to ask the questions and get the answers that have proven to be very accurate. You know, out of this group came the information that the stock market was going to crash in mid-September in 08. So I called my broker at the end of August, and I said, the market's going to crash. Get me out. And then the dollar's going to devalue, and he poo-pooed it, but he did get me out. And I put my retirement in treasuries and silver power shares. And then later on, he called me and wanted to take me out to lunch to figure out how I knew that. So that was kind of funny. And then just a little bit ago, I called him up and I said, buy gold.
Oh,
and he goes, oh, that's too risky. I don't agree with that. Well, since he said that, gold has just been, since we bought gold, gold's just been going through the roof.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the point is that you can use this. And you know, I wasn't asking for information. I was not asking. But I kept going around the office, and everywhere I went, I kept getting this thought in my head, buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. It was annoying because I usually don't worry about the stock market or anything. I mean, I went years without ever doing anything, just letting the retirement stuff sit in there and not even worrying about it. But the point is, you can, especially in a group, I think a group's even more powerful, but even just in your own home, if you do it frequently, you can have a safe space, a sacred space, where information will come to you that is actually very protective, not only of your finances, but your health, other people's health close to you, your pet's health. You know, there's many different things that can help with. So I would encourage people to meditate or find quiet time. You don't have to call it meditation. You can just go for walks, you know, in nature, or, you know, some people find it on the golf course. I mean, there's many, many different ways to find that space where you can actually listen rather than be in transmit all the time.
I want to emphasize the exposure to nature. In my own life, that has been just absolutely crucial about pursuing my own spiritual path, because I find that getting out in especially in true wilderness, that's really away from everywhere, then the focus becomes not you and your ego. I mean, there's something so much larger than you when you're out in genuine wilderness that you become almost insignificant. The ego fades. You sort of meld mm-hmm. into your surroundings. I find that nothing works like that for me except basic wilderness exposure. My wife and I take August off every year and mm-hmm. go up into the wild country in the Wyoming Wind River Mountains, and and just camp. And
yeah.
It's like a reinfusion of energy and awareness. I'm a strong proponent of wilderness because of spiritual reasons.
And I think that, you know, that when you go places where there's not a lot of electromagnetic fields, there's actually a place in Virginia that's a dead zone that they enforce, so you could go there and there's no electromagnetic fields. Going somewhere where you have less of the energetic disruptions that you have in the city or even, you know, in your home sometimes, that is where you can get in touch with whatever you want to call it, your higher self, the universal mind, God. It doesn't really matter what you call it. It is very protective and very important to do that. That's why the Indians had vision quests.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And you might see consider premonitions to be a little micro or mini vision quest.
Yeah, they are.
If you just put an intention out before you go to sleep that you want to tap into whatever information may be valuable for you, that's sort of like setting out on a little nocturnal vision quest.
It is. It is. And, you know, I think people now spiritually are learning to take more responsibility for their own, not just their health, which is very important, but also their spiritual health, and not being so dependent on organized religion. Of course, there's many people in organized religion who are very good teachers and very inspiring, but you also have to, at one point, step out and start taking responsibility for yourself. And I think that's what people are doing. I mean, that's the path that many of us are on. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Dr. Larry Dossey on his latest book, The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. Next week, we will be interviewing Penny Pierce on Frequency, The Power of Personal Vibration. And then Brian Rosner on the 5th of December, The Top 10 Lyme Treatments, Defeat Lyme Disease with the Best of Conventional Alternative Medicine. We had just interviewed him, but we'd only had a half an hour, and we hadn't gotten through even two of the treatments, so we're having him back on. And then on the 12th, we're interviewing Dr. Edward Close on Nature's Mold Treatment, a non-toxic solution to toxic mold. And since we had this flood here in Atlanta, that we've all been dealing with the mold issue. On the 19th, we are interviewing Dr. John Turner, a neurosurgeon, on his book, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. And then on the 26th, we're interviewing a dentist on The Stealth Killer is Oral Spirochetosis, the Missing Link in Dental and Heart Disease. We do not have Noetic Science in December, but we will have it again in January. Noetic Science is the third Thursday of every month, and we have really fascinating people speaking there. And for more information about the Community Health Source newsletter from our clinic, you can call 770-457-4677 or go to www.templeofhealth.ws, and it's up online, as are all of the radio shows. Again, Dr. Dossey, thank you very much for the interview. It was great. Enjoyed talking to you again.
Thanks for having me. Always talking to you is a real inspiration.
It's fun. And Dr. Dossey was kind enough to write one of the endorsements on the back of my book, which is actually released now. It's up on Amazon. It's called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants. And I appreciate you doing that. That was sweet.
Absolutely.
All righty. Well, we will see everybody next week. Thanks for joining us.
You had plastic surgery, Bill?
You bet I did. I got tired of the wrinkles around my eyes and decided to have Plasticos do something about them.
But I didn't think men had plastic surgery.
Get with it, Bob. Men want to look their best, too. There's nothing wrong with getting a little help from Plasticos to look on top of your game. A lot of guys are doing it, my friend.
Well, I don't know about this.
Look, you see the difference Plasticos made with me. I look better and I feel better. My Plasticos surgery was an investment in me.
So where is Plasticos?
Plasticos is in Dunwoody. Plasticos is staffed by pros who guarantee you personal attention. The Plasticos number is 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available. 770-457-4677.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plasticos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plasticos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plasticos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plasticos at 770-457-4677. Plasticos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.